Hey, folks, and welcome to the Grad School Sucks podcast, the show for academics and PhDs who want to take their career to industry. I'm your host, Dr. Matt Carlson, and today I'm speaking with Mark from Life Science Career Coach, an account on Instagram. Mark and I discuss his career in the life sciences and going from the life sciences to working for pharma today. We talk about why working for pharma isn't evil, like everybody thinks, the differences in work-life balance between academia and industry, and how other life science grads can swiftly move their career over to industry by doing just a few things differently. Without further ado, let's get to the interview with Mark. All right, so let's jump into it, Mark. So I know that you came from neuro, you got your PhD, and then you went into the pharma and biotech space. That is, unless I'm forgetting something we've already talked about, the extent to which I know about you. So could you tell me a little bit more about yourself, let the listeners know what your background is and what you do now?
Yeah, so I will start kind of at the beginning. So I work in life sciences. So in life sciences, a lot of times you get a chance to do research and work as an undergrad. So in undergrad, I worked in cancer biology. I really enjoyed that. I spent 2 years in a lab learning how to do things there. And when I went off to grad school, I thought, well, I'll change fields and see something different. I went and got a PhD, and that PhD was in neurobiology, which was pretty dramatically different. And then I changed from that to come work in pharma and biotech. And in pharma and biotech, I do a lot of in vitro cell culture, things like that. So pretty dramatically different. You know, for my graduate work, I was working a lot in model systems with pretty complicated questions. And now a lot of my work is honestly a lot more simplistic. You know, when you add this to a cell culture, what happens? When you take this away, what happens? Does this make it better or worse for what we're trying to do? So pretty big shifts, but that's kind of what I do now. A lot of it is all cell culture based.
Very cool. Could you walk us through the process of, you know, finishing up your grad studies? Where were you thinking in terms of your career? And then how'd you make it over to where you are now?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So grad school labs are dependent on funding, right? I mean, certainly in life sciences, if you don't have funding, it's hard to do stuff. The university I was at, there was some funding. There wasn't a ton, but there was enough that we were doing okay. Well, until my third year of graduate school, my PI hadn't gotten a grant for over the summer. I'm a pretty big fan of, you know, eating and paying my rent. So, you know, I saw these two summer semesters coming up where I wasn't going to get paid. And that was honestly not an option. Up until that point, I was convinced that I was going to be a professor. I was going to have a mahogany-lined office. I was going to have a jacket with elbow pads, and I was going to sit in there and think all day. That's not what professors do, but that's what I wanted to do. So I started looking for opportunities to make money over the summer, and one of those was an internship in industry. And I thought, well, industry is always, you know, it's a big pharma company. Big pharma companies are always bad. You know, all you hear about is big pharma this and big pharma that. I'm a basic scientist, but I'll go and, you know, make some money for a little while. And about 2 weeks into that internship, I realized that I was not going to academics anymore. And big pharma wasn't what I thought it was by a long stretch. And it's actually a really, really cool place to be, doing some incredible things. So that's how I did it. It was an internship first, found the internship. I came back and worked part-time as a contractor through the end of graduate school, which was really, really hard. I don't know that I'd recommend that. And then I did a postdoc at the very same company. And then finally they hired me on in a full-time position thereafter.
Awesome. Awesome. And I love hearing about the internship route, not something that I did, but something that I hear a lot of success about. So what was it in those first 2 weeks that flipped the switch from academia to industry for you?
Yeah. So what it was two things. First, big pharma is not evil. I mean, I know that sounds really silly, but honestly, being a really basic researcher, I didn't really have good thoughts about big pharma.
Sure.
it turns out we are not evil. There is a profit motive that I'm not going to deny that. That's true. But there's really dedicated scientists working to solve really big problems. So the fact that it's not evil. But second, what really got me was the speed that you could do things. At this point, I didn't have a family, so I wasn't as worried about pay or work-life balance. Those things came in later. But the speed at which you could do things, I was accustomed to a medium-sized university with kind of middling funding. You know, I wasn't at Harvard, I wasn't at MIT, I didn't have my own lab credit card. I had a budget in the lab, but it wasn't huge. So I had to be really tactical with the money I spent and how I spent it. When you come to a pharma company, if something's worth doing, it's worth doing today. And you will get the resources, the reagents, those variable width multi-channel pipettes, you know, whatever it is you need to get that done as quickly as possible. And I was shocked. In one summer, I did as much work as I had done in my PhD up until that point. You know, in 12 weeks, I had done what I had done in, you know, almost 3 years before. And on one hand, that really shocked me, in not really a great way, like, man, I'm some kind of sluggard at school, but that's not really the case. I just had better resources, better tools, automation, things that make stuff just happen faster. So those were the two things in those first 2 weeks that really changed it for me.
Very cool. Very cool. And that's not the first time I've heard that, not necessarily from pharma, but a lot of different industries, it seems like, move much faster than academia. And I feel like there's maybe a misconception for people who haven't worked in both, because in academia, we feel like we're busy all the time. But the timetables in academia are actually much farther out. And frankly, sometimes the research is a bit behind what's happening in industry. Do you concur with that?
I do. And I would never fault an academician for saying that they're busy all the time. I think they are. I think the catch is they are busy all the time, but they don't have the tools to make things go as fast as you can.
Yeah.
You know, there are things that I buy off of a shelf now that I would have to spend, you know, half a day making, and I can just order it and it shows up the next day. You know, so that's you know, it takes me a minute to order what would have otherwise taken me several hours to make. That's a huge time savings.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, so can you walk me through what was it like after you had done the internship, knowing that you wanted to go industry and then trying to wrap up your PhD?
Yeah. So after my internship, I went back and I was just a graduate student for another, basically the fall and spring semester. Then that next summer I came back part-time. So that was a pretty, I was early enough in my PhD, I knew that I couldn't get too far ahead of myself. So I basically just made sure that I was making as much forward progress as I could. But things started to change a lot in the summer between those 2 years. Because I came back and I was working part-time in industry while still trying to do my PhD, which was pretty tricky. I don't know that I recommend that. But I really started focusing on, you know, what do I need to do to get out? What do I need to do to finish? You know, I need to publish this many papers and I need to write up this dissertation. I need to do these experiments. All right, well, I've got to publish papers. I don't need to publish papers in the most prestigious journals in the field. I just need to publish papers. Not that I want to do a bad job, but it kind of changed my perspective a little bit that, hey, I don't need to, you know, spend 3 years agonizing over these experiments to try to get into the best journal out there. Find a solid workhorse journal and get it out. Mm-hmm. You know, it'd be great if I had something on the cover of Science, but it's okay that I don't. You know, I changed my focus and what I was doing in the university setting to really just hone in on finishing, not necessarily rounding out all the projects. I did have a really solid team of other students in the lab that by that time I was the senior student, so I could help them figure out what to do. And a lot of the times that was rounding out parts of my project as well. So I still got the satisfaction of knowing the answers to the questions that were coming up. But to be perfectly honest, it wasn't something that I had to go out and chase.
Very cool. Very cool. So could you tell me a little bit about the work you do now? What's like your general title, that kind of a thing?
Yeah, I'm a principal scientist. My work that I do now is basically really early stage research in a pharma company. So I work exclusively with cell lines, which is kind of nice. In life sciences, a lot of times you've got to work, you know, in model organisms and things like that, which, I mean, honestly, is an important part of science, but not a thing that I love. I recognize it's important, but it's not my thing. So I appreciate that I can take a step away from that. So basically my role now is taking cell lines, changing them to make them more useful for what we're going to do, and then testing different things on them is really what it comes down to. It's in a lot of ways, like I'd said, it's actually fairly straightforward. And I really appreciate that. It is, there's still a lot of really intensive design and thought that goes into it, but the region of things that, you know, we work on is fairly concise, and there's some advantages to that. I have worked outside of this area too. And that's something too, that I think people don't recognize in industry, you know, like your boss tells you what you do and you've got to do this thing. No, not really. Not in all roles. And in this role, I'm actually quite flexible, and that's what I'm doing now, but that's not what I've always done. You know, it's been a pretty varied bag. I'm choosing to do something more straightforward now, because honestly, for the time of my life, you know, I want something at work that's straightforward and I don't have to spend, you know, a ton of time on and a ton of energy.
Absolutely. So one thing that I've commonly said about the difference between working in academia and working in industry is that in academia, whether you're a grad student or a professor, you're often wearing a lot of different hats. You're fulfilling a lot of different roles. And in industry, many of those roles get split up and given to people one at a time. So one person may be focused on, you know, operations, another person focused on data. Do you find that in your work in industry, it's much more streamlined compared to working in academia?
Absolutely. You know, I think of my grad school mentor, who honestly, I actually had a pretty decent time in grad school, all things considered. And the things that they would have to do, the different jobs they would have between whenever they showed up and wherever they went home. And I don't know how much you have to pay me to do that, but it's more than I make now. That's a really... it's a really hard thing to do well. Yeah, my job right now, I could make it more complicated, but I don't have to, and I'm not. It is much more streamlined, you know. I wouldn't go so far to say that it's absolutely an assembly line, but it's pretty straightforward, and that's a huge bonus when it comes to the mental energy it takes, you know, to go to your job and do the things you've got to do.
Yeah, absolutely. I heard someone, and I can't remember for the life of me who it was, but someone once compared academia to actually be more like starting a business or being an entrepreneur than actually being a W-2 employee. And even though you're a W-2 employee on paper, and that's something that I've never forgotten. And I really resonated with that when I read it.
I totally agree. You know, I'm really lucky. I have some dear friends and people that I love who are in academics and still in academics and still love it. But to see their workload and how they work, you know, and in life sciences, it's all about grants. If you don't have grants, you can't do anything. And to see, I mean, that's a great point. They're really like an entrepreneur. Like, they need to sell their ideas to these funding agencies, be it NIH or NSF or, you know, whomsoever. And you need to sell these ideas, and then you need to produce information on it. And basically just wash, rinse, repeat. You got to keep selling this stuff. Otherwise, you know, guess what, buddy? Your salary gets cut because half of your salary comes from the grants that you secure. It really is a very entrepreneurial setting. And that's great if you're into that. Mm-hmm. But the downside is you could just go be a real entrepreneur and actually make some money at it, as opposed to, you know, not, instead of all the stress.
Very cool. Very cool. So, Mark, I know your dad, we share that in common. And how do you feel like becoming a father either influenced or made you appreciate your decision to go to industry?
Yeah. So I was ready to go to industry before I became a father. but it has been such a blessing compared to working in academics in this way. We found out we were going to have our first when I had just signed the paperwork to become a postdoc. Had I known at the time, I probably would have tried to get a full-time position. The postdoc's full-time, but of course it's fixed term.
Sure.
Just for that comfort. But I mean, it all worked out in the end. And just the difference in work-life balance, you know, that wasn't what drew me here originally, but that's what's kept me here. The fact that, you know, I can show up in the morning and go home in the afternoon at pretty flexible times. And I don't want to say at my leisure, because that's not entirely true. But, you know, if I show up at 10 because we had to do a late drop off at the babysitter's house, no one's, you know, calling me saying, hey, it's 9:02. Where are you? And if I have to leave early to get them, you know, I can take a meeting in the car or when I get home. You know, there's just so much more flexibility. And the working hours are a lot more reasonable. You know, I routinely work, you know, anywhere from 40 to 50 hours in a week, but very rarely do I work more than 50. Very rarely do I work on weekends. I almost never work in the evening, you know, regularly. With a new baby in the house, that's kind of changed a little bit, you know, just because I find myself coming home a little bit earlier. So, you know, instead of working until 4 or 5 o'clock, I might come home, you know, at 3. And after everyone's asleep, or if the kids are asleep, I might work for an hour or two. But I have the flexibility to do that. And that's huge.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to jump into that. One thing I did want to say is for everyone who's listening, who's not from the life sciences, there are industry postdocs. That's actually a very common thing in a lot of life sciences and STEM areas. Here in the social sciences where I'm from, I don't think that exists like at all. If it does, it's extremely uncommon. But just to give everyone a picture, we're talking about an industry postdoc. And to jump back to the family piece, I have a lot of people who maybe are current grad students or they haven't been in academia, and they talk about the flexibility of being an academic. And I always grin whenever I hear that, because it's like, yeah, you know, you get to kind of make your own schedule. You have to cram a lot into that schedule. And frankly, even though I'm at like a 9-to-5 desk job, I feel a bit more freedom, kind of like what you were talking about in terms of if you need to, you know, move things around a little bit to accommodate your family, that's not looked down upon. And I just think the whole like flexibility in academia thing is quite a bit overstated. And I think if you'd ask people who are, especially in the research world, they would be like, yeah, I do make my own schedule, but I think it's a lack of perspective on what the two lifestyles are like in general.
I agree. I'm going to say a quick thing on the industry postdoc too and come back to that. I did an industry postdoc. You don't have to do an industry postdoc. I chose to because I wanted to work in a particular group doing a particular thing. But you don't have to do that to come to a pharma company at all. As far as the, to the flexibility point. So full disclosure, my wife's an academic postdoc right now. And, you know, so I, of course, know her schedule and interact with a lot of the folks that she interacts with. And it is flexible in a sense, but it's not really flexible. Sure, she can take a day off if she has to. You know, people in her lab can work around things, but I think the number of things that one has to do in a day in academics by definition makes it less flexible than these 9-to-5 jobs. That is a broad statement. And anytime you make a really broad statement like that, sure, there's going to be exceptions. But, you know, I look at the people I know in academics and it's not really that flexible. Not compared to industry. You know, I can work from home if I want to. I don't have to, I can. At least some of the time. It's not so cut and dry. I think a big part of that too, though, is that the road between academics and industry for personnel is almost a one-way street, right? Mm. You know, you'll hear of academics, either grad students, postdocs, professors, going from academics to industry, but you don't really hear of anyone going back. So I think that perspective for folks in academics is missing, because, you know, people that have done both are almost always in industry. And that's for two reasons. A, once you go to industry, you probably don't want to go back. But B, also, and more fairly, it's harder to make that transition back. Certainly for life sciences, you know, you live and die by grants and papers, and you don't get grants in industry, and you don't publish very many papers. So to go back is a really hard thing to do.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. Well, Mark, I'd love to start picking your brain about what do you think grad students, I guess, particularly in the life sciences, should be thinking about as they are approaching graduation and thinking about their career?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say, especially as a graduate student, in the United States, you usually have some control over when you graduate. Once you have all your stuff done, you know, you get to pick a defense date. Don't defend your dissertation until you have a job lined up. Make sure that you have a place to go after you defend. Not that you shouldn't try to be getting out of graduate school, but to be perfectly honest with you, you know, you are getting paid, even if it is a pittance. So be in school until you have a job lined up. Now you need to get that job lined up. Go out. There's a ton of industry internships and things to do like that if you want to go to industry. Go out, apply for those, try to get them. If you don't get them, try just a shadow. If there's no industry presence in an area, so, you know, say if you're in an area where there is no industry presence, you know, look, there's non-traditional roles as well. You know, there's like medical science liaisons, which are people that, you know, pharma companies hire to basically go out and educate doctors about how this drug works or how this therapy works. You know, you don't have to be in Boston or San Francisco to find a job in this space. You know, I'm still in the Midwest. So I would really encourage folks to go out and look for chances to interact with people in industry. And if you can't find any of those, you know, use LinkedIn, use other tools, use Instagram, use places like that to find people that work in industry and make those connections. That's not to say that person's going to be the one to offer you a job, but they'll give you insight into the niche that you're trying to get into that, you know, you don't have yet. And that can be huge.
Awesome. You mentioned Instagram, and I know you've been making content there under Life Science Coach, I believe. Is that the handle?
Career Coach, yeah. That's the one.
Very cool. Life Science Career Coach. Could you talk a little bit about what kind of content you've been making and where you see yourself taking the platform?
Yeah, so that came about, honestly, because the one area in industry that is not great is at, like, proper teaching. You know, there is mentorship opportunities, but they're less. You know, in academics, guess what? You have graduate students that are utterly beholden to you. Your teaching classes, those students, you know, you're mentoring in a way. In industry, you know, you have direct reports, but usually there's not that many of them. And honestly, most of the time they need you less because they're generally fairly accomplished. And sure, you can help them move along, but you know, you're not giving them really basics. You know, they're already there, right? You know, you can help them a little bit, but they're pretty mature as far as scientists go. So the Instagram page is to help inform people in academics that there is another way to go, because that's something that a lot of folks don't see, they don't get. You know, your professors are academics. They don't know as much about industry as someone who's in industry. And they don't have to, they shouldn't. So the page is really there to let people know about that opportunity and to give me a chance to talk to people and do some of that mentorship that otherwise isn't really there. You know, some really basic, like, hey, this is how you do these things. This is how you go over here. This is how you do that. You know, I'm not giving away any trade secrets. You could open, if you look in your lab, you'll see there's a molecular biology techniques handbook, volumes 1 through 3. It's blue. I'm sure your boss has it. I'm not telling you anything that isn't in there. It's just, I've read it. So, you know, that's where that knowledge comes from. But, you know, figure out that there are other places to go. You don't have to stay an academic forever.
Awesome. And I will, we will have a link to your Instagram in the description of the episode for folks to be able to find and click on. Mark, is there anything you want to chat about that we didn't get to yet today?
I don't think there's anything terribly important that we didn't touch on. I just want to reiterate, you know, go out and make those connections, learn the skills. You know, if you don't know how to do PCR and cell culture, you know, some of those, you know, aseptic technique, go out and learn how to do that if you're in life sciences, because those are skills that no matter what you do, you're going to end up needing. And then if you can learn some of the more in demand, more novel skills, you know, CRISPR-Cas9 editing, you know, digital PCR, things like that, that's just a bonus. You know, if you go look at 100 jobs in life sciences right now, you know, cell culture, aseptic technique, and PCR will be listed in 99 of them. And those other, you know, digital PCR and CRISPR are going to be listed in probably half, and they're going to be things that people want. So, you know, go out and get those skills and go out and make those connections, because that's how you do this next stage.
Absolutely. All right, Mark, last question for you. What is one thing you think PhD students and postdocs should consider doing before they leave academia?
Before they leave academia. Have a chance to make sure that you have gotten the mentorship you need, because once you make the transition to industry, it is hard to go back. Make sure you know that's what you want to do. I'm very happy here. Almost all of my colleagues are, but industry isn't for everyone. So make sure before you make that jump, you are sure that's where you want to go. There was a paper in Nature 6 months or a year ago talking about the lost revenues of people who do academic postdocs before coming to industry. And basically the story is this: you know, if you're an academic postdoc making $50,000 to $70,000 a year until you're 40, and then you go to industry, and then you start out, let's say you start out at $100,000, that's great. You could have started out at $100,000 when you were, you know, 31 or 32 when you finished your PhD. And by the time you're 40, you could be making whatever your earning potential is there. And that's true. I mean, there is lost income by staying in academics longer. That's a fact. Also, once you make that transition, it is hard to go back. And if you want to end up at a really high-end university, you know, Ivy League or something like that, it's I won't say it's impossible, but it's nearly impossible to go back unless you have such an outstanding career in industry that you're recognized as a leader in that space, and you won't be making that transition until you're in your 50s or 60s, most likely.
Interesting.
So I would say make sure that, you know, you have the mentorship to know that industry is a reasonable fit for you. I mean, I do think if you can do an internship, it's absolutely worth it. Because there are people that do internships and say, you know what, that really wasn't for me. There's not many, but there are some. And I would never want to steer somebody into something that they're really going to regret, because that's not what we're here for.
Sure. All right, Mark. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. It was great to talk to you.
All right. Thank you, Matt. I appreciate it.
All right, folks. That was my interview with Mark from Life Science Career Coach. Be sure to check him out on Instagram, Life Science Career Coach. I'll have a link in the description of the episode that you can click on if you want to pull up his profile. And I just wanted to remind you that, yes, the podcast is ending at the end of this month, May 2024. I do have 1-2 interviews left plus a final episode, so stay tuned for those. I think those are going to be some awesome episodes for you. So until then, I will see you next week. My first question for you, Mark, what would you say is your superpower, and how did you get it?
What is my superpower, and how did I get it? That's a great question. I think my superpower is probably adaptability. Between undergrad and grad school, I had a pretty big field change. And then from grad school to my postdoc, I had a pretty big field change. Since my postdoc, I've been working in a, you know, I've been working in a similar space, but even still, you know, what I work on day to day changes tremendously. So my superpower is adaptability. And I think I got that out of necessity. When you choose to change fields as dramatically as I did, my only options were to do it or to fail. Mm-hmm. And with some really solid mentorship in grad school, and then more solid mentorship beyond grad school, I've been able to learn a lot of things and get those things done pretty quickly. You know, a PhD is a thinking degree. It's a degree in learning. So hopefully when you're done with a PhD, you should be able to do that to at least some degree.
Yeah, very cool. Okay, next question. If you could go back and give yourself something, whenever you're starting your PhD program, $1,000 or less, what would have that thing been?
Honestly, $1,000 or less, I could probably pick one up used for less than $1,000. And that would be a variable width pipette. I know that doesn't mean a lot to a lot of people that are outside of life sciences, but basically you do a lot of repeated pipetting of different sized vessels and different configurations. And as a grad student, all you really have is time. You don't have a ton of resources as a rule. And with that in mind, your PI will say, hey, here is your single channel pipette, which is, for those that don't know, basically, you know, you can move one thing at one volume at one time. And if you're moving hundreds of samples into hundreds of different, you know, formats, it's extremely tedious. A variable width multi-channel pipette is just that. You've got lots of tips, 8 or 12, and you can change the configuration such that you can move lots of things at once. So you're going to be either 8 or 12 times more efficient in moving things. Kind of a silly thing, but it would have saved me hundreds of hours in graduate school when it came down to it. And that would have been pretty slick. And you can get them used. You can pick them up for less than $1,000. Probably not brand new.
That's awesome. All right. If you could live anywhere in the world, you could take your family with you, price wouldn't necessarily matter. Where'd you go?
It's funny. If you would have asked me this a month ago, my answer would have been pretty different. Mm-hmm. Right now, probably the American Southwest. I can't be more specific because I don't quite know. We have been Midwesterners. Both me and my wife have been Midwesterners our entire lives. We love the Midwest. But this most recent winter was the first winter where we were like, you know what? This kind of stinks. We're far enough away from family that, you know, already that travel to see them isn't super easy. And the Southwest seems like a pretty cool place to be. So yeah, Very that's cool. kind of where we go.
Awesome.